Hello and welcome to Radio Aldie. We're delighted to host a new podcast, The Odd Couple, sponsored by Baillie Gifford, starring the great broadcaster John Humphreys and Matthew Norman, Aldie columnist, formerly The Guardian diarist and Telegraph columnist. For over 30 years, from 1987 until 2019, John Humphreys was the chief presenter on Radio 4's Today programme. Now he and Matthew, great friends, often with severe differences of opinion, lock horns for Radio Aldie. Recording by Yamaha Music.
Hello, welcome to The Odd Couple, a podcast in which I, Matthew Norman, am joined by my old friend John Humphreys.
That's me.
John, how are you doing?
I am doing very well indeed. All the better for seeing you,
yes,
I do.
Yes, I'm sure.
Should we get nasty now?
Yeah, we can get. Let's get the gloves off. But putting them back on, since we last met in this room, you've had some sad news from Dorset.
Yes, my brother died.
Your brother Graham.
Brother Graham. He died at the age of 87.
Not your average 87-year-old, I think. So
not
far as
the average 87-year-old, no.
I know you've written about him, but let's talk about Graham. Because you've talked about him over the years, and he's been a bit of a hero to me, though I never had the privilege of meeting him.
Well, I think he's a hero to a lot of certain kinds of people, really. His great achievement, I suppose, his greatest achievement in one sense, is that he drank on a typical day about a bottle of scotch, smoked.
Seriously? A bottle of
seriously. Typically, yes, in his little room, his own little room.
His little den.
In the house, his den, I suppose you could call it that, couldn't you? There was not a case of scotch. There were cases, plural, of scotch lined
right.
up. So when you took a bottle, when I used to visit him, I would obviously take a bottle of scotch, and I'd say, is there anything in particular you need? He'd say, yeah, but so-and-so I rather like, so you take that. Anyway, right. He had more scotch than he'd ever seen before, plus, of course, another table, the top of which was littered with, covered with, cigarettes. He rolled his own cigarettes, had done since he was a kid. And he smoked about 40 of his roll-ups a day and drank about a bottle of scotch a day. And he did that from about the age of 15, 16.
Okay. Now, I'm not a gerontologist by profession, but I'm getting the feeling this wouldn't be the formal medical advice for how to live if you want to reach 87.
You really wouldn't think so,
no.
would you? We shared a bed when we were little, because as you know, we talked about it last time, I think, and we weren't exactly well off. And we had to share a bed, and he, being about 5 years older than me, I was the little one. I was six or seven, whatever, and he was in his early teens. My memory of him, my longest living memory of him, it'll always say, is having to scratch his heat pumps. And you, you being middle class, wouldn't know what heat pumps are.
I'm not that. This is something to do with not having any central heating, is it?
Or? Well, certainly no central heating. But it was you sweat a lot, and you don't have a shower or a bath or whatever. And
right.
You're basically pretty smelly, and your back.
Right.
And sometimes your face. Well, I've had them. God knows, most poor people did. There are little red bumps, and they itch like hell. So my task as his younger brother, because he'd beaten me up if I hadn't, was to scratch his heat pumps. So that was the relationship we had for a very long time. I did get something in return, because he told me what life was like for a teenage boy. A bright teenage boy, I have to say, because he passed the scholarship, as we used to call it in those days, the 11 plus, to get into a very good grammar school in Cardiff, then proceeded to do absolutely no work at all.
Right.
He simply didn't work. He smoked a huge amount from the age of about 13, drank a huge amount from the age of about 15, I suppose, and did absolutely no work, as a result of which he failed every single subject at O-level, left school without a job, and that was it, really.
Well, as I said, a hero of mine. But and also, another aspect of his heroism is that he wasn't prepared in his last months to do whatever he was told by his doctors. He knew exactly how he wanted to die.
Well, he was never prepared to do that.
And he wanted to die at home.
He wanted to die
at home. As indeed he did.
As indeed he did. There had been plenty of false alarms, because obviously if you're drinking and smoking, he had a basically had half a lung, and he had been in a hospital. Mm. I mean, there had been occasions when he'd collapsed because he couldn't run, all that sort of thing. But he was absolutely adamant. They sent an ambulance for him and all the rest of it because he couldn't breathe. To take him to hospital, and he refused to get in and said, no, I'm staying at home. He didn't actually at that point say, I'm dying at home. He said, I'm staying at home, but everybody knew what that meant.
Yeah. Now, I think this is quite close to my heart because...
I was about to ask you about your own parents.
Because over the 4 or 5 years, I was looking after my old parents, who died at 88, similar ages. Hmm. And I think I learned a paramount importance for old people of taking control as far as they can, or their families taking control of their treatment. Because what they wanted to do with Graham, no doubt, was give him all sorts of meds and stuff that probably might have given him another couple of months of life, but it would have been miserable life in a hospital. And this, I haven't got the figures, but it's tens of thousands of times a year, old people die in hospital needlessly. For no benefit other than the extension of a life that's almost ceased to be a life. No quality to it. They're lonely, they're frightened, in an unfamiliar place. And to buy an extra few weeks or months of misery rather than to die at home with the people they love.
We don't know what their life would have been like. Well, we do, actually. We do. I was going to say what their life would have been like if they had all of them stayed at home. But if you take Graham as an example, his last... 5 years, I suppose. Well, he only had half a lung, as I say. We knew that because he collapsed a long time ago. He wanted to do what he had always done, which was drink and smoke and talk to people who came around and chat.
Now, exactly.
That was what he wanted to do.
And you can't do a lot of that in a hospital. Although my friend Mark Steele, who you know.
Yeah, indeed. Great man, great comic.
He had a surgery, this is by the by, but about a couple of years ago for cancer in his throat. And he came round in a hospital in Tooting, I think, St. George's in Tooting, and there was a Polish guy in the next bed who was making a lot of noise. He said about 3 a.m, he said, mate, can you turn your phone off, please? I've just had surgery. He said, I'm very sorry. And he went and he stopped that. But at 8 o'clock the next morning, on the dot of 8, the guy lit a cigarette. In the next bed, which is also heroic. And apparently, Graham probably couldn't have smoked very much in his hospital bed, and he'd have been lonely and miserable and depressed, and he might have lived longer, but it would have been torture, absolute torture. And, you know, one understands it. You know, the medical profession wants to do something rather than nothing, and all individuals in it, they always do. But my contention is, and it sort of ties in a bit with the whole assisted dying thing, sort of a kissing cousin, but my contention is that there comes a point in a human life when intervening, however well meant, is an act of unwitting cruelty. And you know, Graham wouldn't have it, but Graham was in control of his own decisions. But with both my parents in their last days, I had to fight really hard to stop them being taken into hospital.
But I thought at some point one of them had been.
They've both been in and out for various things. I'll just describe the household, if I may, briefly, in my dad's last weeks, right? So they're in a thin, tall townhouse in northwest London, Primrose Hill.
Several floors.
4 or 5 floors, with a stairlift by then, thank God. And my father is close to death and can't really move, and he's sort of living in a chair. And my mother manages to break her ankle one morning so badly that the foot is sticking out at a 90-degree angle from the leg. So she's paralysed on the top floor, 3 floors up. So we had at one point 8 teams of 2 coming in daily. 4 to look to see to my dad, 4 to see to my mum. 8. In the end, I rang them and said, do you think it might be more sensible to see each team does both, save you time and money? Anyway, and in between them is my then 18, 19-year-old nephew, who's a lovable chap, but bone idle, and he's on his PlayStation the whole time. So it's and there's me, and I've moved in, and I'm sleeping on the sofa in the sitting room with my dad, who's in his recliner chair because he needs tension in the night. He can't really turn himself and needs drugs and stuff. So that's an eccentric household. Anyway, this is August of 2021. not long before Emma Raducanu won the US Open, for those of you who love your tennis.
Gosh, how interesting.
And one Saturday evening about 7 o'clock, my dad, who he always called me Chap, and I always called, family always called him Bronze for reasons I don't think I ever knew. And he says, he's in his recliner, he says, Chap, could you pop it? I said, yeah. I went over towards him and he said, I don't want to bother you. I know, you know, but I've got a very sharp pain in my, what feels like my heart. And as he said those words, I went towards him and I heard this huge gushing noise, as if it was replicating the sound of some sort of internal hemorrhage, but in the house. So I said, it was the most English conversation I've ever had. I said, look, Bronze, I said, would you just excuse me for a moment? There's just something I want to. He said, no, not at all, of course, please. It couldn't matter less. So I went up a floor and there was a huge flood, a leak of water from through the ceiling. And I just stood there looking at this and thinking, for the first time in what's not been an easy period, I just don't know what to do. I don't know which crisis to deal with first. He's having a heart attack, I suspect.
The ceiling's
the house is
in.
Having a hemorrhage. And then I thought to myself, in a way you think quickly when you're under stress, I thought, well, whatever happens at this stage of his life, I'm not calling an ambulance for him. I'm not having him taken to hospital, even if he is having a heart attack, because he's not going to live very long. I don't want him to, you know, and I want, he wants to die at home with me and family around him. I'm not doing it. They come and take him. It's COVID time. Can't even visit him. He will die alone and terrified. So I thought, you know, on that basis, the flood is the thing I can actually do something about. Sorted all that out. Got buckets and whatever, and went back down. Gave him an aspirin as a blood thinner, on the assumption he was. And that was it. And the following Monday, we go to hospital, Macmillan Centre in central London, for his last, what proved his last transfusion. And I had a quick word, a very nice, sweet young Muslim doctor in a hijab. And I said, look, I think, you know, I think he's had a heart attack. I just thought to tell you. So she said, OK, we'll do an ECG. Half an hour later, she comes over. She says, you're right, he's had quite a severe heart attack. I've had a word with cardiology. We're going to have him taken down. They'll put stents in. And I just went to Peter. I said, are you fucking crazy? I said, look at this guy. How long do you think this guy has left on earth? I mean, what would possible advantage point would there be to a procedure that might kill him? Frail as he is.
Just for those who don't know, putting a stent in is it's
not a huge thing, but it's not general anaesthetic, but they pipe things through and they put these things in the arteries to widen them and improve the blood flow. Just open them up. Mm. And it's a much less invasive and dangerous form of, you know, than having open heart bypass surgery. So I said, you know, I broke down. I mean, I was starved of sleep. It was, you know, I was on the edge anyway. And I just started crying. I said, look, please, just have a look at his notes. Talk to his consultant. But you cannot. You'll have to keep him in every chance at his age and his health. And he'll die in this hospital alone if you do that. And I can't allow it. And she came back half an hour later, said she'd read his notes and talked to his consultant. And she agreed that it would be counterproductive to intervene.
Did she, without any...
She did, but I mean, you know, I'm bolshy and I'm a professional hypochondriac, quite well informed medically.
You could agree with all of
Lots
that.
Lots of people would have just said, yes, doctor. In the way that we do, we just say, you know, you're the doctor.
What is our instinct?
And he could have died during it, or he would probably have died in hospital on his own. He died, as it happened, 6 days later, right? But thank God, you know, thank God I managed to stop it. And then with my mum, a couple of years later... I was having a couple of days off. I had a nice woman from Georgia who was looking after her. I went off somewhere, got back to my phone, and there were like 25 missed calls. District nurse had come round to see my mum that morning, found her unresponsive, called an ambulance. There were two paramedics there. Dashed back to the house and had this long fight with a rather cocky young paramedic who was saying, we're going to take her to the Royal Free. And again, I didn't use
Royal
exactly
Free Hospital.
Yeah, which is around the corner, a big hospital in northwest London. And I said, look, I don't think you should. I'm looking at her. I don't think there's any point now. I'm not sure. She's four flights up. I don't know how you're going to get her there. I think you might kill her in transporting her. He then rings the GP, and for over 2.5 hours, multiple calls with the GP, both of them saying she's got to go to the Royal Free, and me saying, I'm not having it. I don't care what the consequences are. It would be an act of grotesque cowardice in me to allow this. She's going to die in her own bed with me, holding her hand, and I'm not having it. So finally, the paramedic was stood over her and was making out his report. He said, I'm going to report that you have, that this is expressly against the medical advice.
Was he being offensively?
He was slightly, officious. But he was covering himself, as people do, and also wanted to do something rather than nothing again. Mm. And I said, all right, mate, take her. If you think you can do this, I think you're going to kill her in transit. You're certain to break limbs. She's very frail. How are you going to get her down 4 flights? You know, you can't get her in a stairlift in this state. And he took fright and said, I'm going to change the advice. I'm going to say, recommend palliative care. Within 2 hours, a doctor comes around and assesses her, leaves me with all the various other people. And she died at 3 o'clock the next morning, exactly 12 hours after the last phone call. And later that day, the GP rang, and this is something that no one's ever heard of before and probably ever again, and said, look, I was wrong, you were right.
Really?
And I thought, well, of course I'm right. I'm 24 hours with her. You know, I know her better and her state than a doctor who's seen her for 20 minutes in the last year. Mm. Of course anyone would. But again, you know, it was a desperate, long, horrible, draining fight. But to die well, you know, that's all you got left at that stage. They'd taken her in. They might have kept her alive for a couple of weeks. I doubt it, but maybe. She'd have been frightened, so far as she was aware of it, in an unfamiliar place, lonely, traumatised. What advantage at that stage is there in intervening?
Not at all. Absolutely not at all.
But they're not trained for this. I did a lecture with them.
Well, you can't really, can you? You can't. If you're teaching a bright young man or woman to be a doctor, you can't say to them, by the way, if the patient wants to die at home, that's absolutely fine, let him die. I mean, you sort of can't quite do that, can you?
Why?
Well, because your job, your profession, your obligation is all about life, keeping people alive, giving them a chance at life.
It's not all about that, I think.
It's not all
I think
about
it is, but I don't think it should be. I mean, I think, you know, the first line of the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm.
First do no harm.
And you're doing enormous harm.
But I mean, by allowing somebody to die, you could certainly argue, couldn't you, that you are doing the ultimate harm.
Well, you could argue that, but if someone's going to die soon anyway, and they're going to die better, and they're going to live in pain and misery and confusion and fear.
But all cases are different, aren't they? I mean, that's such an obvious thing to say.
Yeah, but they're not trained. I did some debate, assisted dying debate, with arguing against assisted dying, was a very good and eloquent palliative care specialist. And afterwards, I said, by the way, when you're at medical school, how long do you spend in a hospice, let's say, being trained to recognise when death is imminent, whether it's pointless and cruel to intervene? She said, about half a day. Half a day in a 7-year training period. Mm. So they're not trained at all to recognise the signs of imminent death.
So
they
all right,
read a chart.
Write a new training schedule then for, we have this bright young woman or man training to be a GP, wants to be a GP. They're going to have an awful lot of contact with patients, the real contact.
Well,
They're going to get to know them in the how do you? I'm just wondering how you frame it. If the patient wants to die, let them die. Well,
it's not that they want. We're not in this case. We're not talking about people who want to die. We're talking about people whose lives are so barely deserve the word.
But who's making that judgment?
Well, this is another of my kind of boring beefs. Everyone must understand the essential importance of resisting medical advice. If you're sure that someone is close to death and wants to die at home and should die at home, and B, must have power of attorney, in which case legally it's your right to override medical advice.
Well,
it's essential.
The problem with that is you are. I'm going to flatter you. God forbid. I'll withdraw it later.
You're having a stroke.
You are immense. Quite. You are, must have had one. You are immensely knowledgeable about medical matters. You even wrote a column, I remember, years ago with a mutual friend of ours at the time.
No, I didn't.
Very.
She starred in it, but
she starred in the column.
Co-write it.
All right. I do remember her byline being there as well at times. But anyway, Sarah Jarvis. And you and she wrote, or you wrote, a medical column for The Guardian.
Well, it was a hypochondriac column.
And you made a thing about being immensely... I'm fascinated why you did that. Why you... I wouldn't use the word... Yes, I would use the word obsessed. You are obsessed with health. Not just your own.
Well, I'm a hypochondriac, yeah.
You're a that's slightly different, isn't it? I mean, yeah, there are hypochondriacs who think they're going to die tomorrow because of 16 different ailments or whatever it happens to be. But you're different from that, because if somebody else, if I say to you over a pint, I've got this bloody pain in my what's it, you're instantly on the case, and by the time I drunk half the pint, you will have given me six different analyses of what's going wrong.
Yeah, but I'm not a doctor, so, you know...
You're not a doctor.
It comes with a warning.
But quite so. But would you, in another world, would you have liked to have been a doctor?
Yeah. Given that I've done the most pointless and worthless thing known to humanity.
I think that, if I may say so, as somebody who's done exactly the same job as you, that is to say, being a journalist all my life, just as you have been, it's not entirely pointless.
But we haven't done the same
thing. An awful lot of it is pointless.
I've been spouting opinions from behind a keyboard all my life. So, I mean, I remember sitting with my dad one morning and these carers came in to see to him. And I sat there and I thought, of these two, you've done more good for humanity in the last 3 minutes than I have in my entire 30-year career. Yeah.
Yeah, that if I may say so.
So, yes, obviously to do anything useful, doctor, teacher, road sweeper, anything that actually benefits humanity would be a preference.
You don't think that being a journalist benefits humanity?
Types of
journalism.
You
don't think society would be stronger, democracy would work better if we had no journalists, do you?
No,
I'd have thought.
No, journalism is vital.
Journalism is rather important.
Journalism is essential.
For journalism, you have to have journalists.
Yeah, but there are forms of journalism that are essential, and there are forms that are the lowest rung of the showbiz ladder.
Of course, and the same with any profession you can.
Okay, well, if I'd be a war reporter or an investigative journalist, yes, that would be.
Well, I've been a war reporter.
Well, then you've done useful work.
But I don't know about that. All journalists, no, that's stupid. I was about to say all journalists do a decent job. Of course there are corrupt bastards out there who do a rotten job and all the rest. Of course there are, obviously there are. But journalists are important.
Yes, right. Vital, more than ever.
Good.
Yeah, my journalism doesn't come under that header.
I
did agree with you, but I'm not going to repeat it.
I'm clinging to this.
I
know it's an empty hope, but did you just briefly, for a moment, change your mind?
No.
No, you didn't.
I mean, nothing more important than journalism, but you could get rid of...
Now you've done a typical Matthew thing. You've got... Of course there are things more important than... If I were dying, I wouldn't want to be seen by a qualified... No, there's no such thing as a qualified journalist, is there? But I wouldn't want to be seen as a journalist. I want to be seen by a doctor.
But if you want to cling on to avoid a kind of fascist revival across the Western world, then journalism is essential.
Yes, it is.
And it's under a tremendous attack, particularly in the United States. Massive attack. Clinging on, but a lot of it's gone now. A lot of the networks have been muted. Slightly. Washington Post is owned, by Bezos, who's sucking up to Trump.
I wonder if that's absolutely true. I mean, of course, journalists are under... I was in the United States, as you know, during the Watergate affair. And a lot of people said, why aren't the journalists doing their job? Because if they were, this bloody man Nixon would have been out, blah, 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 blah. The fact is, had it not been for the journalists, we wouldn't have known about Watergate.
Exactly.
And
it's tragic to see that very paper now being muted and editorially.
But Trump is quite a switch in subject, this, but nonetheless.
Yes.
Trump is... is getting the sort of treatment that both you and I, from journalists, there are certain journalists, that he deserves, and it is proving quite effective. I mean, he's the president of the United States, and he's going to have another couple of years in the job, unless they manage to find a way of impeaching him, which is unlikely, but not absolutely impossible. It could happen, you'd agree with that.
Well, he'll be impeached. It'll almost certainly be, but they won't pass.
They wouldn't get a majority, probably, in the House.
You need two-thirds. That's impossible.
Indeed. But it's not inconceivable, and there does seem now to be, this is a bit of a switch from where we started this conversation, but there does now seem to be an acceptance that he is bonkers, that he is off his trolley, that he is insane. And the sorts of people who might have defended him not all that long ago are now saying, yeah, well, maybe he is just a bit, you know. So who knows? It's possible.
Who knows? Who knows? But journalism here in this country is disappointing, I think.
Well, good.
If we had a free press, we'd never have had Boris Johnson as leader of anything, ever. Because they would have reported on his private life in the way they do with everyone else.
It's because we had a free press, you could argue that we had Boris Johnson.
If the right-wing papers reported accurately on him...
Well, we've got a right... Of course we've got a right-wing papers. We've got some left-wing.
There wasn't a word. Papers that knew everything about his various extramaritals, his betrayals, all sorts of stuff that they did not report.
And in the end, what happened to Boris Johnson?
Became Prime Minister and killed a lot of people.
And then what happened to him?
Killed a lot of people, encouraging people to go to Cheltenham Festival and a Liverpool European football match, spread the virus. No one knows exactly how many, but tens of thousands died who shouldn't have done. If you had a competent Prime Minister then, we'd have had a much lower death figure, I'm sure. Anyway, we are talking of... Yeah, so we're talking of COVID.
Well, that's true.
So that my reflections on the dragging us back to the subject.
Yeah, now, go back.
And the horror of being hospital. My dad spent 3 weeks in UCH in London without a visit, close to death.
Why?
Because he... Well...
Why no visitors?
COVID. And again... I should have kept him out. I should have kept him at home somehow, because the thought of what he went through there, entirely alone, he had to go on hunger strike because his phone fell down, got lost in the bed somewhere, and he wouldn't eat until they wouldn't find it, and he had only way he could get them to look for it was to refuse to eat, and I can't really dwell on it because it would drive me almost literally mad to think of what he went through in those 3 weeks, but. Another reason to keep, you know, whether you're listening, you're a carer, you're a carer, we're all going to go through it, most of us,
not
one end or the other, will either be caring or be cared for. Another reason to stay out.
I won't have a heart attack, I don't know about
well,
you.
Well, we all do. Yeah. Or I could arrange it.
No, it's kind
little,
of...
Maybe a little accident in your bath with a toaster.
That.
Let me know.
Do we negotiate a fee you'll now? Have to, or,
no, I think something in the will... free of all taxes and duties. Uh-huh. Another reason to stay out is because you go in, even if you're not dying or you're not imminently dying, the bureaucracy to get an old person out of a hospital can take weeks when they're perfectly ready to be discharged.
By whose judgment are they?
Because you have multiple departments that need to liaise on it and come up with a care plan.
But if a life is at risk... then that's necessary.
No, I'm talking about when people are ready to be discharged.
But by whose judgment?
By the doctor's judgment. But they can't be discharged until the three or four departments have coalesced to come up with a care plan. And people, you know, spend weeks of bed blocking. I mean, months, years sometimes. So there's incredibly sclerotic, the hospital care for the elderly.
You may have had rotten luck. I'm a wee bit older than you, quite a lot older than you, I'm ashamed to say. Well, I'm not ashamed. Why am I ashamed to say it? I am a lot older than you. I haven't come across many cases like that, if any, in my own family.
No, I'm... It's a pretty small sample group.
I've
come across two in my family in the space of a few months.
And it could just be that you are, dare I say this, a particularly stroppy...
No, it's not do that. You talk to medical professionals and say this is a scourge of hospitals. I mean, everyone knows it is. I mean, there are thousands and thousands.
Well, there's a lot of bureaucracy, hellfire, of course there is.
But getting
in every profession,
getting old people out of a hospital is a nightmare, and that's why there, you know, it's a massive chronic problem for the NHS is bed blocking because of this bureaucratic kind of paralysis.
But you bound... God, why am I defending bureaucracy? But there is bound to be a lot of bureaucracy involved.
Yeah, but it's unbelievably
I mean, if we're talking about people's lives, and who makes the judgment? Do children make the judgments? Maybe one of the kids wants to keep him there and one of the kids wants it. Yeah, so
no, it's nothing to do with, not at all to do with the family when someone's discharged.
Well,
at all. But
then who is it to do with?
Well, it's to do with doctors, social workers,
quite
occupational therapists. Quite. So, but you can imagine
there is bound to be a lot of bureaucracy.
Well, there is.
And there should be.
Well, yeah, but I mean, people spend, if someone's in for three, like my dad was in for 3 weeks. He could have come out after a week, was perfectly medically able. And it took 2 weeks to organise all these different, you know, departments. So keep your old folk or your sick folk, keep them at home, for God's sakes.
If you can.
Well, you can. If you have power of attorney, you can. And you're prepared to resist the pressure.
But Matthew, not everybody's like you.
No. That's what I'm saying.
And there are an awful
people.
Lot of people who would regard having to care for dearly loved father or mother in their 80s or whatever.
Oh, sure.
And they are not capable of doing
no,
so.
No, sure.
So you are the exception.
No. I mean, I'm not...
Come on, you know it. You're the exception.
No, I mean, there are millions...
I don't know anybody else like you.
No, there are millions of people doing this. Some of them are 12 years old looking after sick, disabled
parents.
And is
that right? Should a 12-year-old be looking after an 80-year-old?
If you've got someone that can turn us into a utopia, it will stop. In the meantime, in an increasingly poor and overstretched country, it's a huge problem. Millions of people. So, I'm not saying try and keep someone at home if you're completely incapable of looking after them safely, medically. But if you can, if it's possible, resist medical pressure if you're sure, you know, that they want to die at home and that they can die at home. John, let me ask you then, have you made any plans for your last... days.
I mean,
you'll see us all underground, every one of us. Because seriously, you'll be 110.
I don't say that in a
happy way, but I'm just stating it as a fact.
Well, thanks. You mean you're unhappy that I'm going to live
another
as long as I'm
28
years. I don't think I care about dying. I do care a lot about the last years of my life being miserable. I don't mean necessarily in huge pain or suffering or whatever, but just thinking, oh, God, do I want any more of this?
Yeah.
That's what really scares me. And because of that, some people, ill-informed, obviously, think me hugely eccentric because I get up about 6:15 every morning and I go for a run around my park and I come back and I do exercises and I do that twice a day and so on and so on. I have a ridiculously regimented habit as far as food is concerned. I eat at least 20 different fruit and veg and so on pretty much every day. I don't drink any longer. I might have a half.
It sounds a lot of fun, I must say.
Well, do you know what?
No drink.
I don't drink. I don't smoke. Gave up smoking, obviously, many years ago.
No delicious food.
Delicious food. My daughter would, if she was sitting next to you and you said that, we're sitting in a studio where there are some guitars hanging on the wall. She would take one of those guitars and swing it violently in your direction, smash you on the head.
She's a very gifted vegan chef.
Because she is a vegan chef, and if I may say so, she is a brilliant vegan chef. And some of the food that she has cooked has been some of the best food I have ever eaten. So the idea that you've got to have a big sirloin steak or whatever to enjoy is rubbish. I used to think that.
Were you
a
brilliant vegan chef then?
I used to be a steak and chips man,
Cook a lot of vegan food then, brilliantly.
I did what?
Do you cook a lot of brilliant vegan meals then, like your daughter?
I don't cook much vegan because I'm not good at it. I'm trying to. In fact, she gave me a recipe the other day and talked me down over the phone because she lives in North Wales and talked me down so that I was able to follow every step that she... And I still made a mess of it. No, it's a skill. I mean, come on, you're a cook. You can cook. Mm. You're a good cook. Not with vegan food necessarily, but you can cook. I can't. I'm rubbish at cooking. And I don't care because I like what I cook. I mean, I...
But going back to this, have you taken up lasting power of attorney? Because I really... Anyone listening, for God's sakes... Anyway, I've done it. My wife, I'm a great deal younger than you, thankfully, although not biologically.
Yeah, of course
we did a biological age test. I'd be your great-grandfather. But according to the passport I am, and I'm 62, and I think anyone over 50 should do it, you know. life is so random. You get out, slip, getting out the bath, crack your temple, have a stroke. If you don't have power of attorney, no one to take decisions for you. It is a mammoth nightmare.
The alternative to power of attorney, that's not an alternative, the addition, perhaps, is having kids who you love and they love you. And, I mean, in my daughter's case, for instance, when my mother got desperately ill, when her mother got desperately ill with cancer, she gave up everything, moved from her home, gave up a job, and lived with her mother for the best part of 4 months, and cared for her morning, noon, and night. She didn't need a lasting power of attorney to do that. She was a daughter, and she did it. She did it.
Don't need it. Power of attorney for that. She did it. You do need it to take medical decisions on behalf of someone who can't.
Well,
your brother Graham, going back to him, was always in, and this is unusual at that age and that state of health. It sounds like was always in complete control of the decisions affecting his death.
Well, we all knew what he wanted. And that's the point, isn't it? And if you've got nobody who does know what you want and cares enough about you to make sure that you get it, then the LPA, the lasting power of attorney, is not so important. But yeah.
But in a scenario, if, let's say, he'd had a big heart attack and an ambulance had been called and he had made it very clear that his wishes were to stay at home and die there, and ambulance, it happens, on occasion they call the police in. Because they, you know, they will physically force, you know, use physical force.
Well, I've never
force.
Heard of that happening.
Well, nonetheless.
And it certainly didn't happen with Graham.
No, obviously
he said,
not.
I'm not going to get in that ambulance. And they said, look, sir.
Yeah.
But that was it.
But it happens. I mean, it is a vital thing for people to have, honestly.
Well,
and I would beg anyone listening in my cheery way to do it.
So just maybe we end with this thought. A lasting power of attorney means what for those who...
Well, there's two. There's one for health and one for property.
Mm-hmm.
It means that someone's incapacitated. You can, you know, let's say someone's on life support, or there's a debate about whether to give someone an aggressive treatment, or you need to go, you know, sort their financial affairs out, that you have the legal authority to do it.
You have to have a lawyer for this.
You go through a lawyer, or you can do it yourself.
Some people might be able to.
Yes. I would suggest a lawyer because it's tricky. But it's a vital thing to have. And, you know, this is a huge thing.
In the ideal world, but most people wouldn't have the few thousand quid that it would cost you.
It would cost
that.
Cost a few hundred.
I've done it recently. Have you?
Yeah.
Very charitable.
Well, your lawyers
are doubtless. You'll have to give me the details of your lawyer.
Fancy lawyers at St. James's, but rural lawyers. Anyway, this is something that the mind turns to as you get on. Certainly mine. I mean, I didn't start thinking about my death till I was about 19.
Sorry, you did what?
Thinking about death and how to die. I was at least 19, maybe 20.
You are a bit weird.
But my midlife crisis started then. And I'm a neurotic Jew. I'm not going to lie about it. And a hypochondriac. But there are things people can do to at least shift the odds in favour of a good and dignified and comfortable death.
Last 30 seconds, the three vital things that you do now, I mean, not that you do, because you've done it all anyway. You are listening to this conversation and you are a bit concerned about your health, but only in a fairly normal way. You don't have a horrible disease that you think is going to kill you in the next. But nonetheless, broadly concerned about your health and well-being and having a good death. What are the things you have to do?
I think in honour of your late brother, I think I'll take him as my guide. No exercise at all.
Well, hang on a minute. Don't say smoke 40 cigarettes a day and drink a bottle of scotch a day.
40 Golden Virginia Roll-Ups without filters. And not a bottle. Let's say two-thirds of a bottle of Johnny Walker. And then I'll get to 87.
May I distance myself from that advice, and please do not regard this podcast as in any way serious about medical advice. Come on, be serious.
I think at your age you should start smoking and drinking.
Not talking about my age.
No, I am talking about your age, because I don't think it would affect your lifespan very much, and you might be, but you know, merrier. And
so start smoking. God.
When did you last have a cigarette?
I knew you were slightly bonkers.
When did you last have a cigarette?
When I last have a cigarette, I can't remember.
You'd be shocked by the price now, I'll tell you that.
But oh, I know, I've looked. My God!
Is it like
15? Yeah, we used to buy them. We used to get two woodbines for a penny.
Yeah. Well, you won't get them for that now.
No, it'd be about 40
so,
quid.
So, come on, I think, you know, in honour of your brother, so at least have a drink next week at his wake. Because this teetotal thing is not good for you.
I won't be able to because I'm driving, so I've already...
Well, as Bernard Manning used to, there's nothing worse...
I've already built in my defence.
There's nothing worse than having a car crash when you're stone cold sober.
I'll take you, except for the person who you crash into, presumably.
Well, there's always collateral damage. Anyway, I hope very much that he gets the send-off he deserves, which means everyone very pissed and merry and telling funny stories about him. He sounds like the
well,
guy.
Well, I shall be doing the eulogy, and that will drag the tone down, clearly. That will to be drag the tone down, and that will not be desperately serious, I think.
Hats off, and as I say, I regret not having met him, but I always loved hearing about him, and I hope he gets a wonderful send-off.
He was a great man.
And on that note, we'll say goodbye. We'll be back in a while, and we'll look forward to joining you then.
And thank you for listening.
You have been listening to Radio Aldi, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Aldi magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldi.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldi.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.